I have to start over?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
If you would, we'd appreciate it.
This was a little, probably a second grade, a little tiny second grade girl, very small.
From North Powder?
It was another one. And her favorite, of course, was Saturn, the same as this other little girl. And I told her what she expected to see. She's just asking questions one after another. She wouldn't let anybody else ask any questions. And there was a lot of hands up. But they were interested in what she was asking too. So finally, she seemed to be content with what we were dismissed. And 2 weeks later, here comes the whole school. One after another, these kids come through, and finally, here comes this little girl. I recognized her because she had been so prominent with the question. She made her way up the stairs. There was kids coming up and kids going down. I don't know, there must have been 75 or 100 kids here. And she got up on the chair. She looked through the telescope, and she starts, you know, I see it. I see it. Long pause. Then her whole countenance of her face changed. And very slowly she turned around and she looked at me and she says, "You got a slide in there, haven't you?" The principal of that school was here too, and it took us a long time to convince her that no, there's no slide. She almost had to step her down the telescope to show her. But she said, "Well, maybe, you know." One other little girl, and maybe I talked to the assembly over at Cove many, many years ago. Everybody was out in the gym floor. The little first and second graders and the rest of them, and some of them were on chairs. Principal was over here, and I guess it was the principal. And teachers all around the outside. And to get everything started, I asked them, the whole group just to get something going. How long does it take the moon to go completely around the earth one time? Oh, we had lots of head scratching. If it was the principal, he's scratching his head. So I knew he didn't know for sure. And the teachers were, you know, all kinds of positions. The kids in the class, they were back. You know, you see the moon in the evening rise, and 12 hours later it sets. It kind of looks like every day, huh? And this little girl, little tiny girl, boy, she was a tiny one too. She was only about 10, 15 feet away from me. She lifted her hand up and she put down real quick and put her head down like, boy, I shouldn't have done that. Anyway, I went down to where she was sitting. I says, "Can you tell me how long it takes?" So she whispered it in my ear. I said, "That's right. Would you tell everybody here what you just told me? Because I don't think they know." Well, okay. Wouldn't look up. Just kept her head real low. And I lifted her up, put her on the chair. And I said, "Now say it very loud so they can all hear what you told me." So she stood there for a moment. "I think it takes one moon." Boy, you should have seen the head. The principal, he goes, "Ah, I knew he guessed wrong." Anyway, these little jewels, they just keep popping up.
In all these visits to schools that you've made to talk about astronomy, do you have any idea whether they followed up in classes? Did they build a unit on astronomy with you as kind of the centerpiece and then study more about it?
I've heard of a couple that have come back and told me. One happened to be a nephew of mine, Tom Isaacson. We would babysit him when he was very tiny. He loved to come up. He loved the telescope when he was... He'd ask questions you wouldn't believe. And as he grew up, went through school, high school, he would still come up. He'd ask questions, questions, questions. Okay, finally he went to BYU. He took a class in astronomy. He aced it. And he said he never opened the book. He didn't do it as a profession, but he says he could answer all the questions. He never looked in the book for anything.
Yeah. That's a good example for an individual, but do you think any of the teachers in the Cove School or any other places where you've been maybe had the kids study astronomy for a full week or 2 weeks as a result of your being there?
We always exchange questions and answers, you know, when I'm over there. And there's a lot of questions brought up. And I'm sure that probably questions were brought up that added to the teacher's vocabulary of astronomy. I don't know. But no, I haven't really followed through it.
It sounds as though you generate so much interest in the kids while they're here, mm-hmm. it would be a good idea to capitalize on that interest in the classroom and keep it going.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I had an experience here. This is, I guess, maybe 3 years, about 3 years ago now. I don't remember. But anyway, knock on the front door. And I opened the door. Here's a man and his wife and two little kids. And he introduced himself and he says, Jack, or he called me Mr. Jensen. He says, Mr. Jensen, I don't suppose you remember me, but I used to go to school at Riveria. And he says, I will never forget looking through the telescope. Now, that isn't any big deal. Looking through a telescope is always fun. But this family had saved their money. They lived in Alaska. He moved to Alaska shortly after he got out of high school here. He moved to Alaska. He married a girl, had these two little kids, and he told his family, one day we're going to LeGrand, and I'm going to show you where I look. And they made a special trip from Alaska to LeGrand and back to Alaska just so he could show his kids this telescope.
I hope you gave him royal treatment.
I sure did.
Spend the night, huh?
But they flew to Pendleton, rented a car, came over
wonderful.
Here, and went back to Pendleton and flew home.
Couldn't be a better tribute.
Yeah. So you don't really know what kind of an impression you make.
That's what's always said about teachers.
Yeah.
They never know where their influence will end.
That's it. Yep. Yeah, I had this is quite a few years ago. There was a boy that lived up on the Fox Hill Road up here. And he was kind of a troublemaker in school. Dale Wyatt, he came down and he said, Jack, he seems to be a little bit interested in astronomy. Can you do something with him? So I says, well, let's give it a try. And so this boy came down and he fell in love with astronomy. He says, after a few days, he'd come down every day. He'd walk down every day just to study a little bit of astronomy. After about a week, he said, would it be all right if I come down during the night and take a look through the telescope? He said, I won't wake you up. And for about the next 2 or 3 weeks, I could get up sometimes during the night. I'd hear something. This thing makes kind of a rumbly sound when it revolves. I'd look out here and I'd see the dome turning. Kind of spooky, you know, because there's no lights on. You don't want lights.
Sure.
Okay. And
there he was with his eye glued to the telescope. Right?
So he was out here studying the skies. I left him charts always like these over here. And it was about a month and a half later, Dale called up, Dale Wyatt. He was a principal. And he said, I don't know what has happened, but this kid is a smart kid, and we're going to graduate. So that was 37 years ago. And 3 weeks ago, this kid shows up.
He's an astrophysicist.
Yeah, I wish. But since then, he's married now, a couple of kids. And he made a special trip up just to see the old telescope.
Yeah.
And so it hasn't made a difference with some kids.
Sure.
I don't know. The sciences are... I've often wondered, with all the fun things we have in science, I don't know how kids could get in trouble. There's too many fun things to do.
Science has typically been taught, and I've seen this firsthand, at the elementary and the secondary level, as memorize the textbook and answer some questions at the end of the chapter.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
No.
There's no curiosity about it.
Yeah.
There's no real participation.
Yeah. Yeah. It can be fun. We've had so much fun with it. Here, maybe when Chris was in school, Dave Gilbert, he was a science teacher before he became president of the college.
Mm-hmm.
He'd call up sometimes and Jack. Could we do such and such an experiment up at your place? Sure, come on up. They're not allowed to do those kind of experiments in college. And so, this kooky guy up on the hill, he does them anyway, you know? So, anyway.
Unfortunately, you don't have to grade people.
Yeah, yeah. This particular one was, they wanted to study the Bandicraft. Voltage generator.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And they would bring their own bandograph. They weren't allowed, I guess, to turn it on at the school. It generates about 250,000 volts.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a lot of fun with it. If you've got, if you put your hands on the bulb before you start it, you know, the round bulb on the top end,
mm-hmm.
and stand on a bunch of gallon glass jars so you don't short yourself off the ground. And I said, be sure to bring lots of long-haired girls and boys. And at that time, there was a lot of long-haired boys. So I set up the camera on one end here, because I knew this was going to cause quite a reaction. The first one was a girl that had long hair clear down to here. And she stood up on that. She put the hands on the ball. She said, now, whatever you do, don't let go. And whatever all the rest of you guys in this room are concerned, don't point your finger at her. High voltage likes to jump to points. So if you're going to point at her, use your fist. Okay. First thing that happened, we were up to, I was watching the gadget over here would approximate the voltage. We were up to about 175,000 volts. The girl's hair was sticking out about like this. And somebody did point at the girl. And she almost fell off of the bottle. And the guy ended up, I shouldn't have done that, should I? Lesson number one. Okay, we learned that anyway. And they learned what happened. And then we started. We get up to about 250,000 volts. And this girl's hair... is a ball this big around. And the guy, we turned out the light, and out of the end of every hair is this purple corona. It's creeping around in the room like this. It was the most awesome sight you've ever seen.
Nobody will forget that.
Took a picture, took pictures of all of them, gave them all pictures. I just happened to know this guy makes pictures. I think he lives in the basement too. But anyway, we went through all of these kids. That was one of the first ones. Another time, the kids wanted to, I don't know who called it. I don't know if it was I don't know if Dave Gilbert was still a science teacher or if he became president of the college. Hey, Jack, what do you want to do? We would like to, we're working with X-ray. And of course, they're not allowed to set up an X-ray machine up at the college. He says, you want to make an X-ray? Could we? Okay. So up comes the class, and I said, be sure, see if you can get him up here by 6 o'clock, because it'll probably take us about 3 or 4 hours before we can make an X-ray machine. We're just going to make it all junk. Junk. Just plain junk. Nothing but junk. Okay. They come up there. We go around, and Dave is assigning. He comes over and says, What shall I assign next? I said, wind a coil around this thing here. Piece of bolt. About 50,000 turns. Yeah. Just get it wound as fast as you can. I said, stick this thing in the chuck of a drill and then have somebody feed the wire into it. Oh. So we probably got about 50. We're making what they call an Auden coil. Auden coil.
A-U-D-E-N.
Ancient high voltage generator.
A-U-D-E-N.
O-U-D-I-N. Auden. That's the name of the guy that did it. Mm-hmm. It has a little vibrator on the end. It kind of looks like a Model T spark coil. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that was the basic for our power. Other kids had the propane burners out, cut a piece of Pyrex tubing off, and put some rubber inserts on the end. Inside, we took a penny and put it on a big washer, and with a ball peen hammer, the ball end, we made it concave. That's going to be our cathode. Cold emitting cathode. Over on the top end was a piece of, I didn't want strong X-rays floating around the kid, so we used a piece of magnesium. It's kind of soft X-rays. Even if we're careless, it isn't going to hurt. Anyway, we hooked this thing up. We made a capacitor by taking a piece of PC board, double-sided, cut the copper off of the edge. The board is about this big. We use that as a high voltage capacitor. Auden coil is charging the capacitor, and it's connected up to the TV, to the X-ray tube. We got a razor blade and a fish out of the fridge. And we put right next to the X-ray tube and put a 4x5 sheet film holder right above it. Didn't pull out the light shield or nothing. This is proof for the pudding. Okay, put it on top of it. I had a long extension cord. We want to watch this work. No, you're not going to watch this work. We're going up in the living room. So we took about 40 feet of extension cord with a switch on the end. We went up the living room. We heard this crackling, kind of terrifying sound. And we're up in the living room, and because these are real low power in the first place, we just crackle, snap, crackle, you know, and turned it off. Let's go down and develop it. The same guy, you know, that has this dark room. We turned all the lights out and left the door open, so it is nighttime anyway. Went in and developed it. The first one was the razor blade. And you can see I think I showed John. You can see the razor blade on the film. We had made X-ray. Boy, those kids got so excited you couldn't believe it. Anyway, this is the dumb stuff.
Not so dumb.
Yeah. And I've had kids, you know, physics at school, oh boy, it can be boring. But they sure remember when we made an X-ray machine. And
did they participate in putting it together?
Oh yeah, all of them.
They knew all the elements that went into it and why it worked.
Yeah, I just went around, told them what's available. And they hook a wire from here to here. I'm not going to do it. You guys, you know, this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes fun if you do it that way. I had a teacher, a science teacher in school that operated the same way. And Mr. Eldred, bless his soul, he was the most mischievous looking elf you have ever seen all your life. He would come into class, sometimes he wouldn't say a word. He was demonstrating. I think I told John about, didn't I tell you about the time he mixed some chemicals and drank it? Maybe I didn't. Anyway, I'll tell you this. This is so darn cute. Anyway, Mr. Eldred, he comes into class. He has a whole class. Everybody, they want his class because this is a fun class. Anyway, we went into class this particular day. And incidentally, we had our 50th class reunion here about, I don't know what it had been, 10 years ago. And I asked the class that was there, I said, do you remember Mr. Elder's class when he drank? Boy, do we! Yeah. So it stuck with them.
Okay, where was this school?
Dad, I don't. He comes to class. He's got this big, stupid smile on his face. Like, I guess it's more of a leprechaun smile than you have ever seen in your life. Anyway, he comes in, he sits down at his desk, and on his desk he has a bunch of test tubes and Earl and Meyer flask, you know, and tapered, and some chemicals. Chemicals is sodium hydroxide, CP, hydrochloric acid, HCl, sitting in the bottle. What's he going to do today? I know one neutralizes the other, but we didn't think about anything like that. But anyway, took so much of the sodium hydroxide, NaOH. He pours it in a test tube that he had already marked off right to there. That many crystals in there. And set it down on his desk. Still had that kooky smile on his face. Everybody was, what's he going to do today? You could always hear a pin dropping. Now he takes another test tube out and he pours in right up to that mark he had previously marked. Sets it down. This never left his face, that smile. Now he takes the crystals, pours them in Erlenmeyer flask here. And he takes his hydrochloric acid and he starts dripping it in. Every drop. He really is kind of watching where he's pouring. His eyes are going around the room like this. And finally, hadn't said a word. About 15 minutes has gone by now. And he's shaking this, feeling the bottom. And I don't think he stopped smiling once. He's looking around the room. Boy, everybody's looking at him. I remember, I remember almost holding my breath. I got to breathe. You know, this kind of a situation. Finally, this stuff was cooled down. And then he drank down the hatch. The whole glass. Oh. He's committing suicide right in front of us. Why, you know, still got that crazy smile on his face. And at last, half of the class time had disappeared. And at last, he opened his mouth. He said, everybody go to the blackboard and tell me what I just drank. And we still, it was hard to take our eyes off Mr. Eldred because we expected him to keel over any second. Yes. And so we go to the blackboard. Let's see now. NaCl, you know, plus HC, you know, it's still alive. L yield. I see now. Sodium and NaCl. Yeah, he's plus H2O plus H2O plus H2O plus H. Wait a minute. NH. That's salt. And a whole bunch. Hey, can't you drink some salt water? How how can you forget a day like that?
Yeah.
And it was such a fun day.
I hope you're not giving students too much credit for figuring that out.
That guy was such a genius. And every one of his classes were like that. I really fell in love with science. I had my first telescope when I was, I guess, Grandpa bought me one when I was about 8 years old, 4 inch. One of these Johnson, Smith and Company, you remember? You weren't into science too much. Johnson, Smith and Company was a catalog that big, that fat, about that big square. It had all kinds of trivial little trinkets and toys and stuff you could get. That was printed during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And the telescope, that 4-inch telescope, I think cost, I think it was $3.95. That's dollars, $3.95.
Yeah, that's a lot of money then.
Oh boy, mm-hmm. Yeah. And anyway, that was my first telescope. I had to figure out, it didn't make any sense to me, the way it was set up, a reflector. Put a mirror in front of the lens? Wait a minute. I'm boring you guys.
No, you're not. Should we go look at the clay pit?
Oh, out here?
Yeah.
You want to see that?
Sure. And where the brick factory was.
I don't know exactly where it was.
Yours.
Okay, when? Oh, this thing here is an airplane that was actually designed by a guy in Colorado in 1983, and it's almost entirely made out of styrofoam. If this thing landed in a lake or something, it could still support approximately 1,200 pounds, John.
Quite a lot.
1,200 pounds, that's a lot of people. So it's its own life raft. the sides, you can see here, are inch thick styrofoam. The wings, they're in the shop here. It's a 32-foot wingspan. The kids asked me if it would fly like it is here. I told them, I went in and I did some figures on it. It right there, it weighs approximately 200 pounds, and it has, you can see, a certain amount of wing area. It would take right now. It would have to go 142 miles an hour to take off, which I wouldn't want to be in the seat when it would.
When you first started building aircraft, things like that, you found out that you just didn't go down to the hardware store and buy your bolts.
Right.
Because they had to be certain strengths. Can
yeah.
you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. An aircraft has to be strong enough so it'll lift as much weight as you can get away with. And you don't use ordinary iron bolts because they're too heavy for the amount of strength they have. And so consequently, you use a grade they call an aircraft quality or an aircraft grade. And it's generally, rather than just being iron and carbon, which is ordinary bolt, they use a chrome molybdenum iron. And the molybdenum, or the moly, is something that can triple the strength of an ordinary bolt. This aircraft here the superstructure in it is actually fur. The longerons, or the pieces of wood that go from the front to the back, there's four, top and bottom on each side, is 1 inch by 1 inch fur. Fur has a lot of strength to it. People don't really realize how much strength there is in fur.
Well, that's what they kind of use. Fir and the spruce goose, didn't
they? Uh-huh, yeah. 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 I don't know if they used any spruce in there, but I think the spruce goose coinage was patterned after the fact that almost all airplanes were made out of. But this is my kids, they wanted me to build an airplane, so they talked me into getting a set of plans, and then they would go out and get me the material, and I just built it. I figured I like to build airplanes. This is a 22 horsepower Zenawa engine on the front. If you can imagine flying with 22 horsepower. It has a wingspan of 32 feet. It's 17 feet long. And the total weight of this machine with the wing ready to fly without the pilot is 250 pounds.
Have you had it up here?
No. We've taxied it, and it's a little squirrely because it's a tail dragger. It's very short, and I think it would fly all right, but I have too many grandkids to turn loose. I've just about got the undercarriage changed around. It'll have a nose wheel, and it takes off at about 30 miles an hour.
Do you think you will take off?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay, suicide doesn't worry you.
I've built a number of autogyros. And if the counter for that is we look up the statistics for skateboard death.
Yeah.
Lots more skateboard death than ultralight. So I think I'd rather fly the ultralight.
Fewer people building ultralights than our skateboarding.
Well, our friend Walt Parker had quite an experience, didn't he?
Oh, boy. Oh, my golly. That guy he loved. You know, I always kidded him. He had an airplane on his gravestone. They put an airplane engraved on his gravestone.
I haven't seen it.
You should see
but
that.
But Marchie, she didn't think he'd fly after he crashed the glider.
Yeah.
And he did, and she flew with
him. Uh-huh, uh-huh. So guess what I got on the kids put on my gravestone?
A gyro?
No. Cutest little airplane you ever seen.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Now, they rebuilt the
brickyard. This is where the brickyard was rebuilt after they stopped producing brick out and back. This was what they called a soft mud, but they had mechanized machine to produce brick. A soft mud brick is essentially just a four-sided square that is wet and sanded and slammed by hand a wad of clay until it filled the void. They cut the top off, dump it out on a pallet. A soft mud machine does all that for you and almost hands them to you, see. Anyway, that's where it sat, right in where these trees are.
The first one was where exactly?
The first one was out back. That's where we're going now.
Back of what?
Where we're going. I'll have to show you.
Okay.
Out back of his house.
That's the out back. Okay. In Australia, where the average...
Okay. Do you think that first one was built in the 1890s?
Yes. Someplace around.
Do you know about when this one
this
was
one here was probably, I would say, around 1900, 1910, someplace around.
Did they move it in order to get closer to the source of mud or clay?
I think, just from digging around here, I think most of the clay is too rich. When clay is mixed with the proper amount of water and dried, it has certain shrinkage. Clay that is too rich is called a fat clay, and this clay is way, way, way too fat or too rich. And it shrinks so much that it's awful hard to dry it without it cracking all to pieces.
What compound is it too rich in?
It's a complex chemical of aluminum silicate and aluminum oxide.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The silicate comes in two forms. It's like fire clay is an aluminum silicate that the structure of the molecules forms two planes, and ordinary clay is an aluminum silicate that forms three planes with a slippage plane between the two. Does that make any sense?
Yes, I think it does.
Well, okay. That's why you went out to Sand Ridge and got sand and mixed with it, because of the richness of the clay.
There's too much of the slippage type.
Do you have any guess about what geological processes formed it here?
Clay is actually formed from granite. The decomposition of granite, feldspar, which is a big part of granite, which is aluminum silicate. The main constituents of the surface of the Earth all over is aluminum. Mm-hmm. Aluminum and oxygen, believe it or not. My house is built out of aluminum, you might say. But if it were chemically broken down, there's a lot of aluminum in here.
Try building an airplane out of that same material.
Yeah. Dirt is a real complex thing when you start analyzing.
Is there anything at all left here that tells you this was the site of the second brick factory?
There might be a foundation for a set of pulleys. I don't know if we've ever... Whoop! Drops off. You see this concrete with a couple of bolts sticking out. This is part of a midship pulley arrangement out this way. They've taken the other one out that was over here. And that square area in there, you can see it kind of looks like a square. That was the motor house. And so the main pulleys that cut the speed down from the electric motors or whatever they use was done here in this condor shaft. And right over here on the left, and that way, was the main machinery. The plug mill, the vertical, it had a horizontal plug mill, a vertical plug mill, and the thing that actually produced the brick.
Over. Did you see it in operation?
No.
Was it
it was here when
just
we
falling
came.
Falling apart?
Yes. Just really falling apart. You could see how it worked. Kind of an interesting. Remember I told you that Ed Towery was the owner? He was the owner up until the time that we bought this from him. He only had one leg. And the story behind that is, you see this hole, this deep hole right here? This is where the roll crusher sat. They call them grizzlies and all kinds of stuff. They're just mean looking from the top. And anyway, it was sitting up here, and the horses with the Fresnos, they dumped the dirt up on top, and somebody would shove that dirt down into the crusher. And it had a long conveyor belt. It became this slot. You can see it's graduated, and dump it into the pug mill up here. Okay, one day Ed was pushing dirt into here and he slipped, and one leg went right through the crusher. Took one leg off just like that. And of course, that was his demise, because he never did get out and do much of anything anymore. And the yard just gradually fizzled out after that too. So that's some of the story here. And right in this area right here, over to that tree, this is where the old brick machinery, there's a big building here and right now. This the level right here, you see this level? It used to go straight through, clear to the other end, and that level is what I use to make a lot of brick out of to begin with. That's where all the dryer sheds sat. They had hundreds and hundreds of dryer sheds out here. that were about 7 feet tall. And they had shelves on it, just like a cupboard. And these pallets of brick with 6 brick on it, they would have somebody take them from the machine on a two-wheeled, what would you call it? Like a wheelbarrow with long racks on it. And they would set them on this two-wheeled wheelbarrow, iron wheel, and roll them out to the shed and put them up in the shed. A lot of people of Le Grand, the kids were hired to come after they had sat there for a day or two. Now these bricks that are laying flat on the pallet, they're drying on top, but the bottom where they're sitting on the pallet is still wet. If they let them sit there, they curl up like a board. So they'd have to come out and go through a process they called edging. They'd, little kids, big kids, always get a job at the brickyard, go out and edge the brick. It's like this all day long. I can imagine them going home at night still. Wow, what a process. You know?
How do you think the bricks got from here to downtown where they needed them to build?
To build?
Yeah.
Everything was horse and wagon. Mm-hmm. Everything was horse and wagon. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's the way all the time Ed Tower was here. With the exception of right at the last, they started using some motorized equipment. But everything around here was set up for a horse and a Fresno. You've seen a Fresno.
Yes.
Two-handled.
Mm-hmm. Gary Webster showed me one.
If you've ever operated them, you'll find they'd be kind of interesting.
Yeah.
You catch something on that cutting lip, and you could end up over on the front side of the horse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Or should we go out and back?
You bet.
There's the house up there. And clear across over to the right side, you can see there's an abrupt drop. But that isn't the clay hole. This is just a kind of a preliminary.
Why are you telling us about this?
This slough here and the one out back used to go clear across, way across where the railroad track is. And when the railroad finally they decided to build it here, they had to cut this great big, and they used that clay as a sub base for the railroad. Railroads always, as I understand it, use about 2 to 3 feet of clay when they're going through a city as a sub base, and then they put the rocks on top of that. It's kind of a cushion here, so that the trains don't wake up and shake your hand.
I think, Eugene, if you look at this angle here, you can see where the hill is there, and then in comparison where the hill is and this little rise here would show on that early 1800 picture that we're pretty much in the area where the original brickyard was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And can you start to see a road coming right up the hill right there, kind of a slot?
Yeah, I think so.
Now that used to be quite a prominent road up to the highway. Mm-hmm. And when they'd bring like sand in to make brick, why, that was an access route down into this.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine it's right in here someplace at the brickyard, the original brickyard. We can go over here and look at the
Valley sausage set right over there across the river. And I've got a picture of that and an aerial view. And
Have you seen any remains at all of the original brick factory?
No.
Nothing left.
There was nothing at all here when we came. I haven't been out here for a year, John.
No, I can appreciate.
Huh. This is kind of weird. Looks like somebody's dug a hole. But the city garbage used to be about as far over as the farthest houses over there, too.
That's right by the river, wasn't it?
On this side of the river, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, you see how much clay has been taken out of here now?
No, I can't see that.
And, but I can't imagine how high this has been through here. They said they, in a record that I had found someplace, but I don't know where I'd seen it, that the clay deposit was quite high where the railroad track is. Now, we're making the approach down here into the...
Are these hills right here in front of us part of the clay deposit?
Are they what?
Is this part of the clay deposit?
This here is mostly gravel, is why they didn't go any deeper here.
The clay deposits were higher up?
Yeah. When you get up to about the top of where you see it there, then the gravel disappears and it's just clay on top. This is the clay hole out here. This and what was, however high it was, I don't know. A lot of alfalfa.
Yeah. Sure'd have to come down to your Peter horse.
Yeah. You can see why the motorcyclists like it out here.
Motorcyclists used to use this as an area that they would go up the hill or what have you. Several people got hurt, not to mention it was quite noisy for the Jetson family.
Mm-hmm. Let's quit that stuff, eh?
Yeah.
Huh. It looks pretty clayey right here.
You can kind of see up to the top and then higher. This is it goes way back in the back there. You can see it too. But that's quite a chunk of clay. But then you know the best place to see how many brick were consumed is go up and down the alleys downtown. That most everything you see is brick. The front might be wood or brick or something, but
there's a dead fawn down there.
There's a what?
Fawn, dead fawn.
Oh! Oh my golly! Fell down and broke its neck or something.
Now, what's your theory about this?
The what?
What is your theory about this?
The guy that bought the place, he's thinking about building houses through here. So this is all his doing.
Well, I don't see any I could photograph that looks much like clay.
I have come out here and got clay back into here, and it's just about the right consistency for making brick, but there isn't just little deposits left.
But it's all grown over, right?
Yeah.
So it just looks like a grass field.
Yeah. The evidence of what used to be here disappears real quick. Lumber and Van Patten Lumber Company. It was right after World War II, and of course, you go and ask a dealer to sell you a tractor with a front end loader, and they would probably laugh for the next 2 hours. And anyway, I built my front end loader, and John Whittemore, he
manager of Van Patten at the time, he come up and he saw that. No, no, it was before John. It was, I forget now. But, would you build us one, you know, Jack? Oh, golly, I got a brickyard to build. Come on, we'll pay you a good price. And so I built them one. But it was built better. Now the Grand Lumber, they get a little bit jealous and stuff. I told them I'd build them one too.
Do they but, still have them?
Huh?
Do they still have them?
No. Yeah, that was 50 years ago.
Well, you can say something like that if you don't mind too.
Oh, shoot. The reason John calls it Watson was because I bought one of these amphibious ducks after World War II, and I used a lot of parts out of that amphibious duck to make the tractor. And in on the dashboard of the amphibious duck, the guy that had driven it, he had about five or six swastikas on his dashboard. His name was Watson. So for that reason, the kids thought it should still be named Watson. Oh, boy.
Give you this and let you listen to us,
Watson. Oh. Oh. Now you can see what's here. As long as all get out. There's a reason for it. I wanted to bucket as far forward as I could. And, of course, you have to have counterweight in the back, right? And, now, very little of what you see here is the original Watson. But, some of it is. But I wanted as short a turning radius as I could, so I stuck one wheel in the back, and that crazy thing has been running for 50 years.
Yeah.
And it won't die, so we keep using it.
It still operates on propane, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it, that's the craziest thing you've ever seen. You can see that bucket in the front? That right bucket here. Is an ancient, about a 1900 Fresno. It had 4-foot diameter wheels with iron tires on it, and they pulled it with a team of 6 horses. And I thought, gee, that's just about what I need. That thing's made out of wrought iron. Are you acquainted with, most people don't know what wrought iron is. But, did you ever study wrought iron, John?
No, I didn't. Why don't you explain it so that...
Wrought iron is... you can't hardly buy it. I don't know if you can buy it anymore, but wrought iron, is ordinary iron that still has a lot of slag in it. And the slag is kind of like a sponge. And the sponge is still full of iron. And you can heat it up until the iron in the sponge liquefies, but the sponge doesn't. And anyway, that's, you can heat the two ends up and pound them together with a hammer. And that's what you can do with the steel in that bucket there. You can actually weld it with a forge and a hammer if you cut
yeah,
off.
Yeah, it has a lot of strength.
Yeah, it's but it's very fibrous, very fibrous. They think it might have been the thing that ruined the Titanic. Very low grade iron.
Yeah.
And it wasn't capable of the stresses they put in it, because they've analyzed little slivers of it, and it kind of acts a little bit like wrought iron instead of steel like we have today. But anyway, with Watson here, I couldn't find a cylinder the main cylinder on top. So I got a piece of Shelby tubing and polished it up on the inside, put some threads on one end. That became my main cylinder. And for some strange reason, it still works. Commercial ones don't. They work.
Got a question to ask you. Was that an early attempt at making a stand for your telescope?
No, that was for a TV dish.
Oh.
Yeah, it was clock right.
Yeah, I didn't know what.
Yeah.
Your own satellite dish?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Did it work?
Yeah, it's still sitting over in the picnic area over there. Incidentally, that's part of a satellite dish on top of the observatory, too. So it was
the part that...
on the top.
Yeah.
It rotates.
That has a kind of a fun history. It used to be sitting on Mount Emily up there, pointing upward. You know, they'd take a signal, bring it in, amplify it, send it back, and go up. Well, they have de-icers that melt the ice and keep it from... One of their de-icers on top didn't work. They got about a half ton of ice on top. They went down and just sheared the lower parabolic reflector off. And that's what's sitting there.
Yours for the picking?
Huh?
Yours for the picking?
They brought it up.
Oh, they did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This place has been here so long, I can't help but think of once my son Chris, he was babysitting the translators up on Mount Fanning, and we decided to take, we ground an 8-inch telescope too, beautiful 8-inch telescope. Chris still has that in stem. But anyway, we hauled that clear up on top of Mount Fanning. Boy, oh boy, I have never seen such a beautiful sky in all my life. All the smaller views below it.
Yep.
And we left. We're going to come back Monday. We came back Monday and the telescope was gone.
Oh.
Somebody picked it up and hauled it.
Mm.
And we had two school classes that were going to this before that we made it. Two school classes, 1 week from then, and the next one a couple of days later that was going to come up. And so we called the state police to kind of be on the lookout. We never expected to see it. And they said, we'll find your telescope. First thing you know, it's broadcast on the radio. Everybody in La Grande found out about Mount Jensen Observatory telescope has been stolen. Everybody was out looking for the telescope. Somebody called state police, a farm. Almost over at Cove, out behind the farm. How in the world they saw that? There's no roads or anything out there. Some little kid called the state police and said, I think I saw something that you talked about out at that farm. Next thing, now this is 2 days later. Next thing you know, the place was swarming with state police. They went out and looked. He said, whoa, golly, I thought somebody just abandoned it. And, they hauled that telescope up immediately. We got the thing set up, and two of the state police that were out there had students that were going to be in that class. I got to thinking, this stuff isn't mine. This belongs to La Grande, Oregon. I just get to run it. another one of those crazy ones. Are you getting anything off of this?
I think so.
Uh-huh.
I hope so. I guess.
Yeah. Well, what's next?
I don't know.
Well, is there anything that you would like to tell us that we might have inadvertently not asked the right question or something that was important to you?
Well, we came here in... about 1941, and I got to know people pretty quick because the first thing we did set up the brickyard, And I've seen a lot of growth. I've seen a lot of the commercial buildings disappear. I've seen a lot of people move in and out. I've seen a lot of people move back because they like it here. And in my travels in World War II, I was a radar instructor and I traveled most of the states in the United States. And if I had my choice to do it, to pick a place to live all over again, I don't think I could find a place that I like better than LeGrand. And that's saying a lot. Every state I've been in has some particular little thing I don't like. New York, too big. Los Angeles is moving too fast. You know, Miami Beach, Florida, nice in the winter, but lousy in the summer. This is the way it goes all over the place.
Well, name one or two or three of LeGrand's or Union County's specific assets.
Yeah.
Things that you like. What would they be?
The weather. I like the weather.
You like really hot weather or really cold weather?
Well, it isn't really hot, I don't think. I don't mind a few days of hot. I've also been in Needles and seen them cook eggs on a piece of steel out in the sun. That's hot. Winters don't get awfully cold. We have lakes around close enough to us. And I don't know. I right here where I live is, I've always thought was such a nifty place. We can, we had three boys and three girls, Jean and I, we could choose up equal sides and have a war for one, you know. Where can you do that? When I was in New York, I visited a friend up on the seventh floor of an apartment building. They were raising children where their playground was about 20 feet of hall space outside the front door. And if the kids were very quiet, they could walk up and down their playground. Mom of this particular place was so enthralled, she had carried one little sack at a time, dirt, up to her window box. And she had about a half a dozen radishes growing in the window. And I thought, holy mackerel. I'm pretty lucky where I live.
Yes.
I can't imagine living like that. I got to get out and call on my friend John to help me cover up my water pipe. It's going to freeze. Yeah, well, you can see what I do around here.
Yeah,
can you imagine me doing this downtown even?
Nope.
No?
Nope.
And I feel real fortunate.